I'm now joined by Ambassador Stephen Rapp, who is the United States' Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues. Previously, he served as prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone and as senior trial attorney and chief prosecution at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He's here in Los Angeles in support of a new documentary film, Nuremberg, It's Lessons for Today, which is currently playing at the New Art Theater. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Stephen Rapp.
Good to be here, Ian.
And of course, a correction here, the film Nuremberg is new. However, it was made in 1948, and it's a very, very faithful depiction of the trial itself. You see all of the Nazi war criminals. You see the case brought against them. You see the case in their defense. And then the verdict, and of course throughout this film, it's essentially is a history lesson, really, about how the Nazis came to power. I thought that was interesting in the context that we mostly focus on the Holocaust. However, the Nuremberg trial really went into the genesis of World War II.
Well, exactly. And I should note in this movie that, you know, it was made by Stuart Schulberg for the U.S. military government in Germany, intended to be shown there and eventually in the United States. And it's been restored by his daughter, Sandra, who has gone back. It had been entirely narration beforehand. And she's found the sound of the Nazis and of the actual trial, and so she's using the real sound with subtitles sometimes and a new narration, but the video is exactly what it was in 1948.
And it felt like, when, particularly in the end, where all of the Nazis basically say, and these are the senior people, the most senior being Hermann Göring, but Speer and others were there on trial, and they more or less all said, oh, it wasn't me, I didn't know what was going on, it was all Hitler's and Goebbels' fault, you know, blaming it on the dead men. That had echoes to me of the current sort of defiance that Ratko Mladic has towards the International Criminal Court in The Hague, where he's now housed. He's more or less saying, oh, this is absurd, this is a monstrous trial, etc.
Well, I mean, there's the political attack that you have no right to judge us, that these are acts of states as individuals. We were just following orders. There's that. But there's also, in most of these situations, once people realize that the evidence is there of massive atrocities, the tendency is always to say, somebody else did it. It was a militia group off on a frolic of its own. That might be Mladic eventually saying, I didn't know they were going to kill those 8,000 men and boys. I was there, you know, trying to fight for the rights of Serbs in eastern Bosnia, and somebody else did this, or some leader who's no longer with us, in this case Hitler or Himmler, they were the ones that did this monstrous thing, and we didn't know. And of course, the evidence that was presented there was, the great thing about Nuremberg is, unlike even in these modern situations, they had enormous public records that had been written, a material that the Nazis had made themselves. As the chief American prosecutor, Justice Robert Jackson, said, there's no count of this indictment that can't be proven by the Nazis' documents
exactly.
Alone because of this Teutonic desire to record everything. And so these men were largely
including
convicted
the lies,
on their own documents.
But the point of the of tracing the genesis of the war, where they made it really clear that these people, you know, employed deceit and lies systematically, and yet in private they had the notes of what their real intentions were, and you know, it really gets down to this dilemma and question I've always had about this. I suppose it goes back to Bertolt Brecht's play The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, which was a satire on the rise of Hitler, making him an obscure sort of, I think he was trying to take over the cauliflower concession in the Chicago markets. And his thesis is that history judges these tyrants and psychotics based upon the numbers of corpses that they piled up. And in Hitler's case, it's something like 50 million, rather than who they were as individuals. And when I was watching the Nuremberg film, it reminded me that this was a motley group of gangsters and misfits and total lowlifes.
And largely that's the case, though. It was interesting. As you know, at the end of the day, three of these individuals were acquitted, and they were, frankly, the most aristocratic of the group, including Jean-Marc Schacht, who'd been the finance minister who helped build the Nazi German economy before the war, of course, largely through rearmament. And he was saying that Hitler let people out of the jails and into positions of power. Now, in the end, Schacht is able to get along with the idea that, well, he was dealing with the economy, he wasn't dealing with the war, he wasn't dealing with the atrocities. So he was acquitted. Von Papen, who had actually been the one who had decided, he'd been the last chancellor before Hitler, that it was time to bring Herr Hitler into the government, but give him only 3 seats and they would be able to control him. And he's acquitted in the end. He's sort of a Junker aristocrat. And then Fritzsche, who'd been the number three to Goebbels in the propaganda ministry, he'd given his propaganda was fairly light. It was generally misrepresentations and lies about how the war was going in order to build morale, but he never really said anything inciting in terms of killing people, and so he was acquitted. But a lot of the others were extreme low lives. Streicher, who edited this horrible newspaper Der Stürmer that was just full of vile, you know, calls for the Holocaust. The Jews of Russia must be eliminated, exterminated, root and branch, etc. I mean, he was such a bad guy that the Nazis actually had him under house arrest during most of the war, but Hitler liked him and he still published his newspaper. So there were a lot of these thugs, but in the end, they controlled the state and they made the decisions that resulted directly by their intention in these monstrous crimes.
So how does that differ, though, from the current situation? Because I recently spoke with Daniel mm-hmm. Sower on the occasion of Mladic's arrest mm-hmm. and asked him that question. Is this about politics or about criminality? In as much as Milosevic basically was the finance minister or the central banker, he took the treasury of Yugoslavia, parked it in personal accounts in Cyprus. He emptied the jails and created these Arkan and all these criminals, etc. The fellow that you tried in Liberia, Charles Taylor, was a psychopathic killer, etc., etc. I mean, you go through the whole list, Mladic included. Are we doing ourselves a disservice where we wrap these people and dignify them with some kind of sovereignty?
Well, I mean, they're political actors, they're leaders. I mean, they're individuals that that make decisions that lead to monstrous crimes, and they're let's not forget that these folks are also very clever politicians. They didn't get there just suddenly overnight by magic. They got there by building up support, by taking calculation on what would help them gain and retain power. And what we seek with these efforts at justice is to send a signal to them that there are consequences, that you can take the path of it may not be the most noble holding of office. There may be lots wrong with the way you're doing it, but you can do it in a way that doesn't involve targeting an ethnic or racial group for mass murder. But if you do that, if you target those folks, there are consequences. You may end up in The Hague. Your dream of staying in office and dying in your sleep in the presidential palace is lost. Your dream of maybe a comfortable exile in Europe, if eventually you lose power, is lost. So recalculate. And those that are with you, that are deciding whether to follow you, can see what's happening to other followers. And maybe they don't go along. Maybe they defect, et cetera. And so in the process, we're hoping to have something like we have in the criminal law, which is, in a civilized country where you don't stop all crime. But through the deterrence, the point that if people do the crime, they may do the time, you probably prevent 90% or more of the criminal acts that would occur if people didn't face consequences.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Rapp, who is the United States' Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues. But it does seem, though, just in terms of proportionality, that if you go through all of the wars we've had since the collapse of the Soviet Union, starting with George Herbert Walker Bush's war in Panama, where we went after one guy who was a criminal and there was collateral damage. I'm not sure how many innocents were killed in that. However, that we went after Saddam Hussein twice. We went to war against him twice in order to get one bad guy. We did the same with Milosevic in the Balkans. And I'm wondering whether there is a dysfunction here between going after the countries where these dictators are, and I know we didn't target the civilians, but there are civilian collateral damage, so the question is, these people who die, their only crime is that they're victims of the dictator, the same one that we want to get rid of. So has there been any progress in this new post-Cold War security landscape so that we don't have to go to war against these countries, but we can somehow get these guys?
Well, do keep in mind that, you know, within individual states, you have governments that have the monopoly on the use of force, and if, even if someone's a powerful gangland leader, if you can get your, unless your law enforcement is corrupted, you get them, you arrest them, you charge them, you've got the ability to stake them out and bring them to justice. Internationally, we don't have anything like that. These tribunals are created usually with an obligation on states to comply with their orders, but obviously if the states are actually run by these guys, you don't expect them to turn in their own leaders. And so how do you get state cooperation? There certainly have been cases in these international tribunals where we've been successful in getting state cooperation, in which eventually what happens is, in the case of, consider Milosevic for a second, obviously we intervened in 99 because of the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, and through a 78-day bombing campaign, you know, he withdrew. He was indicted. Then eventually he was defeated in his own country. There were these issues that you mentioned about his own corruption that led to action in his own country. And finally, the prime minister of Serbia turned him over to The Hague under international pressure. It wasn't necessary to send in troops to get him. Now, he was weakened 2 years earlier by this military action. Maybe if that hadn't occurred, it would have been impossible ever to bring him to justice. Certainly the Nazis situation, we wouldn't have been able to try Hitler ever, you know, or certainly not the people we got, like Goering and Hess, had we not defeated them in right. World War II. So quite often, to make possible an arrest where people have actually taken over a state, it may take a military force. And that's an imperfect instrument compared to what police can do in a well-ordered, you know, law enforcement, yeah. justice-respecting society. You know, those of us hope is that we can develop stronger obligations of cooperation with these tribunals. We had it in the Rwanda tribunal. We had a tracking team, an international team that went all over the world to find these people, arrested them in like 26 different countries. We then worked very quietly with local law enforcement to find them, and we were able to effect these arrests and bring them out. Now, that was to a large extent because these men were no longer in power in Rwanda. They'd been overthrown by the RPF in 1994, but they were in different countries, and they paid off people in order to protect them, and we were able, through international pressure and having a team, to make these arrests. So, I mean, we're beginning to do some of these kinds of things at the international level that we did at the national level. And, of course, it's our dream that people that commit these crimes against humankind will be brought to justice without the need for war, and that we'll in the end have a system of law, you know, that will replace the need for the use of force. But that is, frankly, a long time away. And the focus of what we're doing now isn't on, to some extent, what they did at Nuremberg, which was to prosecute the Nazi leaders for fighting a war of aggression, an unjust war. We don't really deal with that question about whether the war is just or not. We deal with the question of whether, as people were engaged in a war, they intentionally targeted men, women, and children, or whether they committed crimes against humanity or genocide, whether in a war or not, which are part of widespread attacks on civilians or extermination of civilians. We focus on those things. We don't necessarily focus on, at this stage, on whether the war is just. But in the process, you know, we're sending a signal that if you commit these crimes, there may be consequences. The results are uneven, but we do have a Milosevic arrested, a Charles Taylor that I prosecuted, a Mladic now brought to justice. That we're, you know, we got Bashir, an arrest warrant against him for the last, you know, 3 years, not executed because he's Sudan. In control of Sudan. And in a few days, there will probably be an arrest warrant against Gaddafi. And executing that arrest warrant
and the
will be challenging.
Australian Foreign Minister called for an International Criminal Court arrest of Bashar al-Assad as well.
Well, and that's and we'll see how that goes. At the moment, the UN Human Rights Council has established a fact-finding commission to deal with the crimes in Syria. But because Syria is not in the ICC, the only way a case can get to the ICC is through action of the UN Security Council, which takes, you know, 9 votes out of 15, but no veto by us or by the Russians or the Chinese. In the case of Libya, because the Arab League unanimously called for action on Libya and on Gaddafi. In February, there was a 15-0 vote, with even China, you know, voting to refer Libya to the ICC, and that's why the ICC prosecutor has applied for arrest warrants against Gaddafi, his son Saif, and al-Sanusi, the head of the intelligence service. We'll see if the judge is granted. But whether we'll have that in Syria will depend upon whether the evidence shows a tie to Assad, and then whether whether the Security Council is willing to do that. And it will be more difficult there because Syria does have some supportive countries among the P5 who may veto or threaten to veto any referral, which is shows that, mm-hmm. you know, there's not always an ability to get justice in these situations, but there's the threat of it, and there's the possibility of it, and there's a sort of a line being drawn, and even countries that aren't supporters of international justice, like Russia and China, when the line is drawn in an outrageous way, have been willing to go forward and allow international prosecution, as in the case of Sudan and most recently in the case of Libya, and we'll see about other situations as well.
Well, of course, it's pretty flagrant what's going on in Libya and also in Syria, but there's also examples like North Korea. People are starving, very repressive, well, probably the world's most repressive government, and also Burma. So there are these places on, and again, at the risk of sounding naive, I'm just wondering if there's any way that we can evolve a international system of moral sanctions, other sanctions that isolate these regimes short of having to intervene militarily. Is there enough tools in the toolbox? I know there were lots of financial attacks, if you will, on Milosevic's money. There are ways to internationally to starve the beast. How far along are we in that regard? And obviously you mentioned China and Russia essentially being on the side of some of these rogue regimes. As we know, China is on the side of, so is India, by the way, on the side of Burma.
No, indeed. And unless you have sort of a unanimous position in the world on issues of sanctions, it's very hard to make them effective. And in the case of Burma, the United States and the EU maintained sanctions and targeted sanctions on the regime in Burma, trying to focus on the leadership and the military and not on the civilians and purely humanitarian assistance. Not completely effective because those sanctions, other regimes in the region, and certainly, as you said, China, continue to trade actively and you know, seek investment opportunities and everything else in Burma. So, you know, what can you do? You can go to the Security Council and get binding sanctions, which we did recently with a lot of effort. As I'm sure you read, it took us more than a year because of Iran and the possibility of it developing a nuclear weapon. We have sanctions there, but still a regime that has enough resources that it can, to some extent, avoid it. So these are imperfect tools. In the Burmese situation, what we're pressing for now is a commission of inquiry, seeking an international commission. The Burmese exile community is 100% for it. There's support by a number of countries that it would at least, through an international commission, which might not even be given access to Burma by its government, document the mass crimes, the political prisoners, the killing of tens of thousands of people, the destruction of thousands of villages, rape, murder, forced labor, etc. But to document that specifically, now where does that lead? It leads then to sort of an international expectation, well, what are we going to do about this? And with the facts, with the truth presented in a way the world can't ignore, it may lead to further action like this. It's the first step. And the people who, you know, I talked to on the border with Thailand and Burma, refugees, including whether they came out 20 years ago or 20 days ago, they all say this is a good idea because it'll send a signal to some of the people that are committing these crimes that the world cares and they're watching. It may dissuade some, won't dissuade all. But it's because of what we've created with these other tribunals that then this risk begins to come up. And so in each of these situations, we're working on what we can do internationally to bring these matters to attention and then to use the pressures that are available in a world of sovereign states to change conduct. And certainly in the long run, in cooperation with the people of these countries, to develop a way to hold people accountable. I should note that, I mean, our essential policy, and in the U.S., it's always been this, was part of the International Criminal Court, which we're not in, but as part of its doctrine, the idea is that you always want to have justice in the country itself. I mean, we much prefer that countries prosecute their own and develop their own approach to accountability, and that international justice is appropriate when they don't. and when they can't, and they don't have the will. And so that's the idea. So obviously in Burma, when you talk to people like Aung San Suu Kyi, she says, well, I'm not sure that something that should go to the ICC, but we need to have accountability. We need to have reconciliation here. So at the moment, that's our focus. And, you know, it's a close-run thing in terms of whether we can get the support in the Human Rights Council to get this approved, because the countries in the region generally have an attitude of non-interference, and they don't want to press these issues. But we're working on it, and I think we'll get there.
Just in closing, then, just to go back to the Nuremberg film, which has been resurrected, and in October 1948, when the sentences are read, which you see in the film, invariably the sentences or the verdicts are crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what happened to crimes against peace, because it seems like a very powerful notion.
Well, the idea of crimes against peace, came from the you know, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which we helped write in the late 1920s, which prohibited aggressive war. And at Nuremberg, because of the very clear evidence that the Nazis really did develop a plan to aggress against countries, even while Hitler was saying, we love the Czechs, we're not going to do anything with the Czechs, freedom-loving people, we're not going to go in there, boom, he does. You know, same with Poland, same with Greece, same with all sorts of other situations. So it was clearly an aggressive war, but nobody has developed a court post-Nuremberg to deal with these kinds of things. Now, this has been an issue that the ICC has dealt with because they do have it in their statute to criminalize aggression. But the approach taken to it, in our view, this is an American view, and this was as they were developing an amendment on this issue at a time during the Bush administration where we weren't involved at all in the negotiations. It's written in a way that would prohibit perhaps even humanitarian interventions to protect people or to provide aid, et cetera, that if the country didn't agree to this, you could be charged with aggression. So we're not completely happy with the approach that they're taking. We were in an ICC conference, the United States, and co-led the delegation there in Kampala, Uganda last year, where this definition was worked on, understandings were reached. In the end, the decision about whether to move forward with a crime of aggression was deferred until 2017. But that issue is still very much out there, and trying to figure out how to do it in an appropriate way that doesn't prosecute efforts to protect people from atrocities and terror is the key to successfully figuring out how to challenge to meet the challenge of aggression and of unjust attacks on other countries.
Well, I thank you for joining us today, Ambassador Stephen Rapp.
Enjoyed it very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Stephen Rapp, who is the United States' Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues. Previously, he served as prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone and also served as Senior Trial Attorney and Chief of Prosecutions at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He's here in Los Angeles in support of a new documentary film, Nuremberg, Its Lessons for Today, which is currently playing at the New Art Theatre. And thanks to Donna Walker for her help in arranging the interview with Ambassador Rapp. I'd also like to remind you that Nuremberg, Its Lessons for Today, is one of the many films available to members of the KPFK Film Club. Film Club members can contact the New Art Theatre for tickets. I'd also like to thank producer Spencer Downing, Kim Nassiter, and assistant producer Ian Rowe. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. You can download this and podcast this program at ianmasters.com, where you can also check out my blog. I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Santa Monica, Reverend Wayne Christensen of the League of Displaced Women in Colombia gives a slide presentation on the work being done by the group. The League is defending the status of women in Colombia who have been displaced by the conflict between Colombian government, paramilitary groups, and the FARC guerrillas. It is also working with these women in building a self-help community that provides some refuge from the conflict. This event, sponsored by Peace and Social Justice Committee of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Santa Monica, takes place Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. at the church. Call 310-410-4420.
In Los Angeles, the Party for Socialism and Liberation presents a class on the role of a revolutionary Marxist party, covering what kind of struggle and leadership is needed to achieve a revolutionary victory. Discussion will focus on the need for a party, what it has meant in revolutions throughout the world, and how a Marxist organization can change history. That's Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the party office. Call 323-810-3380.
The Ventura Film Society presents the film Bandit Queen, telling the true story of Phoolan Devi, a member of India's Dalit Untouchable caste, prosecuted by Indian police and turned into a legend by the Indian press. After 11 years in prison, she ran for and won a seat in India's parliament, the first Dalit woman in history to do so. The screening takes place Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the Museum of Ventura County's Smith Pavilion. Call 805-628-2299.
Silent Wednesdays at the Cine Family features a new 35mm print of Battleship Potemkin, Sergei Eisenstein's 1925 classic about how a mutiny aboard an armored cruiser becomes the rallying point for a Russian populace ground down under Tsarist rule. This version restores numerous missing scenes and all original title cards. That's Wednesday at 8 p.m. at the Silent Movie Theater on Fairfax Avenue. Call 323-655-2510.
I'm Marlena Bond.
And I'm Terry Guy.
With a community calendar for Monday, June 6th on 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake, and on the web at kpfk.org.